proceed to the next case of the day. The second case on this morning's call is number 03-4136, Terry McKenzie against Milwaukee County. Mr. Retko, let's just take a minute and let the courtroom clear before you begin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Retko.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am attorney William Retko, and I appear on behalf of the plaintiff this morning, Terry McKenzie, who appears here in person also. This time I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. For the purpose of this oral argument this morning, Your Honor, I'd like to focus in on the gender discrimination part of this case. The district court held that the gender discrimination could have gone to a jury trial on the mosaic of evidence theory. The district court did not allow that to happen on the basis that the district court found there was no adverse job action. Terry McKenzie appealed that particular finding this morning, Your Honor.
Do you disagree that it's a common practice, in fact, a desired practice, apparently in the Sheriff's Department, that officers serve periods of duty in various departments or bureaus?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason is that in this particular case, the Drug Enforcement Unit is a specialized unit. You have to be recommended to be part of that unit. Not everyone in the department is qualified to work in that particular unit.
Well, is it your position then that an officer assigned to that would then virtually stay there permanently and not move to any other bureaus?
It's not a common practice for officers in that bureau to leave involuntarily, Your Honor. They leave voluntarily on the basis that it's for a promotional position or they've gotten burned out doing the drug work.
High stress.
Right. In this particular case, those didn't occur, and that was not part of what this transfer was about. It was not a transfer for discipline. It was not a transfer for performance issues. It was not a transfer for rotating personnel. Deputy Inspector Delaney, who's on the command staff of the Sheriff's Department, testified those items were not part of this transfer. The transfer was merely an undesired transfer initiated by Deputy Inspector Paris, who wanted McKenzie out of the Drug Enforcement Unit.
You stated that Deputy Inspector Paris, in the briefs, you stated that he used his good old boy network against anyone who opposed him. That implies that he used it against men and women alike. He seems, therefore, to have been motivated by something other than concerns about gender. How do we get around that?
Easy, Your Honor. The mosaic of evidence shows that Deputy Inspector Paris treated women like objects, not police officers. Deputy Inspector Paris has a pattern of treating women more harshly than he does men. Deputy Inspector Paris did, in fact, at this same time, upon being transferred into the Drug Enforcement or into the Criminal Investigation Bureau, of which the Drug Enforcement Unit is a part of, also caused Captain Schnagel, who was a female, to be transferred at the same time. He had two particular targets when he transferred into that unit. One was Captain Schnagel. The other was Detective McKenzie. He only treated women in that fashion. And more specifically, Your Honor, in this particular case, if you look at the similarly situated employee, which would be Detective Rivera, you will notice Detective Rivera did not receive the same treatment that Detective McKenzie received. Detective Rivera and Detective McKenzie had been in the unit for about the same amount of time. Both of them were the most productive detectives in the unit. And both of them were perceived by Deputy Inspector Paris as being Delaney people when he first transferred into the unit. In fact, both of them were called into Deputy Inspector Paris's office at the beginning of his tenure as head of the Criminal Investigation Bureau, in which he told both of them they could stay as long as they wanted, as long as they produced cases, and that he did not want them to fall into the impression that he perceived them as Delaney people.
Can you tell me where in the record we will find a description of the job responsibilities for the job Ms. McKenzie was transferred from and the job she was transferred to. You see, nowhere did I see describe the duties of her new position, except that it said in the brief that it was responsive work rather than investigative work. And what I'm trying to figure out is how the new position was objectively inferior, because from everything in the brief, it seems to be a lateral transfer, and you're going to have to show more than that.
Your Honor, I'm glad that you brought that to the point. You're correct. All the record states is that other detectives in the Drug Enforcement Unit indicated that as a detective you investigate rather than respond to what deputies do. However, you'll also find in that record that in addition to McKenzie believing this was a demotion, that the business agent for her union believed it was a demotion. You'll see where Deputy Inspector Delaney viewed this as an adverse job action because it was an unwanted transfer. You'll also find the union representative testified at his deposition that detectives were supposed to earn 50 cents an hour more than deputies, and that he perceived because she was a detective she should be getting that pay. You'll also find in the record that Deputy Inspector Delaney testified that it was an adverse action because she just simply didn't request to leave. And typically speaking, other members in the department, such as Deputy Gonzalez, when she saw the transfer order come over, with McKenzie being the only person listed on the transfer order, that it was a punishment, that she was in a position where she wanted to be and was being transferred involuntarily to a different position. Your Honor, in regard to the actual job description of what a detective does, there's very little in this record that would indicate that. But based on those comments, it's clear that it was not a desirable transfer and it was not a lateral position. Because
wasn't she originally going to transfer to patrol?
That's where they wanted her to transfer to.
And then she requested to go to the courts, which was headed by Delaney?
Originally, Your Honor, she requested the time-honored practice of members from the Drug Enforcement Unit when they get transferred out of the unit to select where they wanted to go. Her first choice was to remain in the Criminal Investigation Bureau to stay a detective within the department. She wanted to stay in another Drug Enforcement Unit, a HIDTA task force, or some other task force within the department. It's like those task force that the department participates in with other law enforcement agencies within the community. She wanted to stay there. They would not allow her to do that. She did not want to go to patrol.
That's because Paris was supervised those departments, right?
That was what.
Well, I guess my point is that ultimately she had she made a choice and they honored that choice. She didn't go to patrol. She went to the courts, right?
That was her third choice. That's her third choice, and that was because her first two choices were blocked by the sheriff and by her captain, Captain Richards. Made the decision initially that you're not going to be able to go there because Deputy Inspector Perez is there. She went to the sheriff. The sheriff said the same thing. In fact, at that time, the sheriff acknowledged that she was in a hostile work environment by indicating to her he was waiving the two-week provision within the contract to transfer her immediately because of a hostile work environment.
Is the diary in the record?
Yes.
Were the contents of the diary ever publicly revealed?
They were not published to any member of the department. They were not proceeded into evidence until the start of this case, Your Honor.
Well, then how can the diary be a matter of public concern?
The comments within the diary were indicated by McKenzie throughout the investigation in which she made complaints about her treatment. However, the actual dates, times, and events were not described or produced until the actual filing of this case.
All right, so try and help me with this. Exactly what was revealed?
It was her diary in regard to the dates as to events that occurred within the department. She diaried an October-November entry, which indicated that Perez had not contacted her in regard to the John Doe investigation.
I know, but who learned about it and how? In other words,
she revealed it at the time that Captain Richards was informing her of her transfer. She indicated that she'd been keeping notes in regard to events that had been occurring in the Drug Enforcement Unit for the past 6 months, and she thought the sheriff needed to learn about these events, and she was going to request a meeting with the sheriff so that she could discuss those events with him. That's when it was revealed, Your Honor.
The fact of the diary, or what the diary included?
It was a little of both, Your Honor, because she indicated she had these notes. She indicated she wanted to speak to the sheriff about the events that she had kept notes about. But the actual detailing of the events didn't come out at that time. They came out somewhat during the course of the internal affairs investigation that was to follow based on Perez's and Richard's request to have McKenzie charged for coercion and intimidation. Questions were asked of McKenzie during that process, which she revealed information that would have been contained in her diary, or that was actually contained in her diary. And at that particular time, it was later learned in the depositions of this case that Captain Richards admitted that when he was asked questions about things that McKenzie said, he told her, and he denied during the investigation. Upon learning McKenzie had taped his conversation with her on May 10th, had to come to the fess up to the truth of the matter that, in fact, he did make many of the statements that McKenzie had indicated he did make, which he denied to the Internal Affairs Division.
How does her diary involve a matter of public concern rather than a private employment issue?
Your Honor, it's because it talks about the harassment she received. It talks about the discrimination she believes she was subjected to.
But where's the public value, given that she never broadcast it and refused to let anyone know the content? I'm having a terrible time with this.
Your Honor, she did make complaints to Sergeant Hagedorn on 10 separate occasions and to Captain Richards on one occasion about the treatment she'd been receiving by Deputy Inspector Perez, and she indicated at those particular times that she believed Perez was treating her poorly because she was a female in charge of a large John Doe investigation.
Okay, help me here. Did she keep the information private?
No.
No?
Throughout her complaints with Hagedorn and to Richard, she specifically disclosed specific instances of harassment and of discrimination to them, and they always told her, we understand that you feel like you're being picked on because of your gender, but we don't worry about it. Just brush it off. He won't be around here forever. Now, in regard to the specific contents of the diary, did she ever bring the diary to work and start reading out of it to them? No, she didn't.
Then how is it protected by the First Amendment?
The particular diary?
Yeah.
Because it contains her information, which she had been complaining about, to Hagedorn and Richards. It was her notes and it was her document that she was going to use to support her position so she could remember specific dates, specific details, and specific people involved in the circumstances. And it was that diary that caused the punishment that she received on August 8th.
Even though no one had ever seen it or what it included?
They punished her for it because she didn't have it with her on the day that she made the statement that, yes, I have this diary and it contains this information. But she had made complaints to Hagedorn and to Richard previously about the treatment she'd been receiving. And that's detailed throughout the record in this case, Your Honor. At this time, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Etko.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Ms. Bergenson.
Good morning. I'm Lisa Bergerson with Linder and Marzak on behalf of the appellees. A couple of things that Mr. Reckel brought up that I'd like to address right off the bat, because assertion that there was a 50-cent-an-hour pay to be given to detectives in the Drug Enforcement Unit is completely not supported in the record. First of all, there was a proposed finding of fact during summary judgment proceedings that there was no change in the rate of pay or benefits when that transfer occurred, and that was not disputed by the plaintiff at that time. And the collective bargaining agreement in this case is very clear that all deputies are categorized as Deputy 1, and they are all paid the same. There were 20 to 25 individuals on a separate addendum to that collective bargaining agreement who were, quote-unquote, grandfathered in, who had been in the unit in Criminal Investigation Bureau, and only those people were entitled to this 50 cents an hour increase. And Ms. McKenzie's name was not on that list. In fact, at her deposition, she testified that she never received 50 cents more an hour when she was in the Drug Enforcement Unit. She was not entitled to that, and there was no loss of pay upon her transfer. The other issue that I wanted to address that Mr. Brecko brought up is he relies so heavily on Deputy Inspector Delaney, and in particular today he brought up Inspector Delaney and his opinions, if you will, relative to this transfer. But Deputy Inspector Delaney was moved out when Deputy Inspector Paris was moved in, and he had absolutely no involvement or knowledge regarding the circumstances or the reasons for Ms. McKenzie's transfer.
Do you view this transfer as a punishment?
No.
All right. How do you view it?
I view it as exactly what the evidence demonstrates, which is Sergeant Hagedorn believed that Ms. McKenzie was so bitter and angry at Deputy Inspector Paris that she was communicating, spewing this anger and spitefulness to the others in this very small unit. And given that Deputy Inspector Paris's status and given that he was the commander, the ultimate commander of this unit, Sergeant Hagedorn felt that that one of them had to go and it wasn't going to be Deputy Inspector Paris.
Let me follow up on Judge Kaney's question, because in the red brief, what you said was that working in patrol was not a downgrade or demotion, but there's no cite to the record. Where will we find evidence in the record to support this? I mean, we know she's ultimately transferred to court. Where would we find evidence about whether a court's assignment is a demotion?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, she was assigned to patrol. Sheriff Baldwin testified that he wanted her to go to patrol. He felt that that was going to be the most beneficial thing for her career. And the fact that she chose to go to court was her choice. So we've chosen to focus on the fact that Baldwin wanted her to go to patrol. And if I understand what you're asking me, Sheriff Baldwin testified that whether you're in patrol or whether you're in the Criminal Investigation Bureau, that you are using the same exact law enforcement investigative skills that these deputies are trained for in the academy. When they're in the academy, they're not trained to be a drug enforcement officer. They're not trained to be a patrol. They're trained in all the investigative and law enforcement characteristics, if you will, that they are going to employ on the job, regardless of what bureau they're transferred to.
I mean, couldn't we almost take judicial notice of the fact that being a detective is viewed out there in the world as a lot better than being on patrol?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree with that. In fact, the testimony that's in evidence in this case is, in fact, Deputy Inspector Delaney testified that to get into the Drug Enforcement Unit or to get into the Criminal Investigation Bureau, they wanted to see somebody who had at least a year of patrol experience. But he testified that they waived that for the Drug Enforcement Unit because they couldn't get people to go to that unit. It's a dangerous job. You have to hang out in bars. You have to pretend that you are a drug dealer. You work late hours and you pick through people's garbage at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. There was just as much testimony from witnesses in this case that they had no desire to do that job as there was.
Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's a dangerous job to be president of the United States.
But not everybody.
I dare say you would think that that held more cachet than most jobs.
No.
I'm talking about objective evidence in the record, not somebody's subjective musings.
Well, the objective evidence in the record is rather scant. I mean, we know what the drug enforcement people do, and we only know what the patrol deputies do based on our own personal experience with that. All I can tell you is, based on what's in the record, is Sheriff Baldwin testified without contradiction that he felt the same skills and experience and characteristics were employed in all of those bureaus, and there is no evidence in the record to contradict that. The other...
Deputies cover the jail, or is that a corrections...
No, deputies were in the jail. In fact, the record would support the fact that, for the most part, when deputies were initially assigned to the department, that's where they spent the first, few years or so. And from there, they
were used as a punishment location?
The jail? No, I think it appears from the record that it was used more as a training ground.
There is other cases in which Sheriff's Department use that, take people off the road for punishment and put them in jail as jail guards.
In this record?
No.
Oh.
There are cases.
That may be certainly Ms. McKenzie was not put into the jail.
I guess my point was that there is indications there are some bureaus less desirable than others.
But, Your Honor, I would have to say that based on the testimony in this case, the people who were actually working that job, that really came down to personal preference. There were just as many people who testified that they would much rather be doing patrol work than drug enforcement unit work. And one other point that Mr. Reckel raised, involuntary transfers in this department were very common. There were a number of witnesses who testified that they were transferred from this bureau to this bureau to this bureau. No explanation was ever given to them. They didn't necessarily want to go, but the collective bargaining agreement gave Sheriff Baldwin and the sheriff preceding him the right and the discretion to transfer individuals to where they wanted to go. And according to Sheriff Baldwin, again, uncontradicted, that if you were, if you had worked in various departments or bureaus under his tenure, he viewed that as a favorable thing for promotion. And that evidence is uncontradicted. The bottom line is that this transfer did not cause any quantifiable or qualitative change for Ms. McKenzie. And I wanted to address some other points, jumping, I guess, to her free speech claim.
Let me just ask you something. She was addressed as Detective McKenzie, I take it.
I don't know. Other than her counsel, I'm not sure who addressed her as Detective McKenzie.
Well, afterwards, what was she addressed as? Officer McKenzie?
I wouldn't know. I mean, that's not in the record. And I would say on that point that the collective bargaining agreement specifically did not delineate any differences in status among the deputies. At least as far as that collective bargaining agreement was concerned, they were all the same, to be moved about as the sheriff felt needed. And the use of the detective's badge and the title of detective, the evidence is uncontradicted on that point that it was only to be used as a working title.
The bottom line is, though, that this particular individual had to leave this unit because of a tension between her and the ultimate commander of that unit. And isn't the whole question we have in front of us as to whether or not that commander created an environment where she had to go, and she had to go then because she was a woman. And if that's true, can we really say that it didn't hurt her career? It's all right to get involuntarily transferred. You want to hang around Unit A for a little while longer, but everybody says there's a rotation and you got to go to B. That's one thing. But it goes all the way up to the top guy that we got to get this gal out of this unit and into another unit, you know, because she and the sparks flying between her and the commander. That doesn't sound to me like a career-enhancing situation.
Well, first
of all, if he created that situation and did it because of her gender, he's got a problem.
But he didn't create the situation.
Well, tell me about that. Tell me your version of this evidence, because these things tend to be fairly subtle, and doesn't sound like a nice place to work.
Well, that I would disagree with that, but let me address it in this way first. First of all,
you put up with this language? You wouldn't think this is a nice place to work. This guy wasn't a nice fellow to work for.
Your Honor, he didn't say anything of a derogatory nature to Ms. McKenzie. If I had worked under George Parris, as Ms. McKenzie did, he never said anything to me that was of a derogatory nature. And that's the crux of the case. And in this case, it's about Carrie McKenzie, despite efforts to make it something bigger than that.
So your view of the evidence is she had a chip on her shoulder?
My view of the evidence is that George Parris, for the most part, left Ms. McKenzie alone. They worked together from October of 2000 to August of 2001. For the most part, they had no interaction. He was dying of cancer. He missed 500 hours of work, more than 500 hours of work during that period of time. If you look at the record to see how much contact they actually had, it's about these five or six face-to-face contacts. October of 2000, she doesn't complain about that. January 22nd, 2001.
This is what I want to hear from you, because I don't care how many times they had contact, I want to know what effect did he have on her employment status. That's the name of the game.
Well,
so go ahead, you're right on target. That's exactly what I want to know.
Okay.
Let's go through those
all
incidents.
Right,
tell me what happened and your take.
January 22nd, 2001, he calls a John Doe status meeting. She's the lead investigator. He wants to know what's going on with the case. The case is a year old at this point, Your Honor. And
now, her view is that meeting was a setup. He surprised her, and the other people around weren't around. And in other words, this was the usual way to have a reporting detective come in and give you a briefing.
Well, the usual way, Deputy Inspector Parris, we don't know what his usual way was. The only experience we have with him is from October of 2000 to January 22nd of 2001. So to say that this isn't the usual way, we don't know that. We don't know what his usual way was. But he has Captain Zahner in there. He has Detectives Fisher and Wolf in there. So clearly not everyone in that unit was gone.
Record that particular meeting?
No, that one she didn't record. But for the most part, what was said isn't in dispute. The bottom line, what comes out of that meeting is he tells her, this case is a year old. I want this case to get done. I want you to give up your other cases, focus on this case, and here is the most experienced officers I can give you, Detectives Fisher and Wolf, and I want you to use them in whatever way you see fit. You know what? Then he doesn't talk to her again until May 10th of 2001.
This is number three now.
This is number three.
Okay, tell
May
me.
May 10th, 2001. Now he calls all of the command staff and most of the detectives who are involved in this particular John Doe case. If you look at the transcript of this meeting, because this was recorded, he hardly says a word. And what he does say during that meeting is, what's the status of this case? What's our strategy going forward? And what if this and what if that? What's going to happen to this case? And the only notable thing about that meeting is Ms. McKenzie. When he politely asks her to sit down, she says, no, this is my case, I'm the case agent. And he has to ask her again to sit down. And the meeting goes on, and every other person, other with one exception or two exceptions, felt that that conduct was inappropriate. Not that his conduct was inappropriate to her, but that her conduct was inappropriate to him. Okay, go ahead.
No, please.
So the next meeting you have is May 14th, 2001. He calls her and Sergeant Hagedorn into his office, and all he says to her, for the most part, is, what you did in that meeting on May 10th is unacceptable in my opinion, and I want you to know that if you ever pull this again with any other command staff personnel, it's not going to bode well for you. He's basically giving her advice.
Was this meeting recorded as well?
The May 14th meeting? No. But we essentially adopted the version that was in her book. Then they don't talk again. They don't have another face-to-face meeting again until June 22nd. And all that is Deputy Inspector Paris. When Sergeant Hagedorn and Miss McKenzie return to the office from effecting the John Doe arrest, he approaches them and congratulates them. Prior to her transfer, those are the only face-to-face meetings they had.
And she indicates that there was something sarcastic about this, because I didn't quite follow that.
She claims that the next day, Deputy Inspector Paris went to Sergeant Hagedorn and said in a sarcastic manner, "So was McKenzie surprised when I said congratulations to her?" I don't know that you can read anything adverse into that or anything based on sex. I mean, the bottom line in this record is that there clearly was some clashing here.
Two questions then, if I may. Your take on this commander, I guess, is that he's kind of a gruff, no-nonsense, result-oriented guy, and she had a thick skin. Am I correct? That's your view.
She had a thin skin.
Is that thin skin?
That is my
That's
view.
Your view. Okay.
That is.
Secondly, is there, though, and these conversations that we've just talked about, these instances, aren't they, they're two sides to the story. Why shouldn't a jury hear this? Why should we be bouncing this out at summary judgment?
Well, Your Honor, we basically accepted her version of all of these conversations, and I would submit to you that based on her version of these events, that there is nothing to suggest that anything George Paris did relative to Carrie McKenzie was based on her sex.
Okay, well, Ms. Bergson, you've been very helpful. I'm going to give you 1 minute to summarize because I've monopolized your time, and I'm going to increase the time of the other side to compensate for the extra time you've been given. So you can take a minute to summarize it if you wish.
Okay. The summary of my overall, of all of these claims is, first of all, there has been no adverse employment. There was no adverse employment action. Therefore, the sex discrimination case was properly dismissed. There was no... the conduct relative to her hostile work environment claim was sporadic, it was inconsistent, and there was no evidence that it was based on her sex. And furthermore, I would submit that the district court properly found that we established the affirmative defense even if she were able to establish that her work environment was hostile, which I say it wasn't. She had to show that her work...
I think we have that.
Okay. And then finally, on her retaliation claim, again, the district court properly found that claim was never pled and was properly dismissed on that basis. And then after her free speech retaliation case, please don't lose sight of the fact that claim was against Sheriff Baldwin only. And you needed to look at what Sheriff Baldwin knew or didn't know, and it's undisputed. She never told him what was in her book. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burks. Mr. Retko, I'm going to give you 4 extra minutes if you care to use it.
Thank you.
I would appreciate, in summary form at least, your version of this harassment situation.
Thank you, Your Honor. On January 22nd, 2001, it's undisputed that Detective Fisher, who was also present during that meeting, came up to McKenzie after the meeting and told her that he did not want her to think that he felt she did not know what she was doing, nor did he want her to feel that he was taking over her case. He informed her he had very little knowledge that this meeting was going to occur. He was given like a 30-second warning that you better get into the deputy inspector's office, we're having this meeting. And McKenzie felt she was in front of a firing squad. And Detective Fisher's comments confirm that, in fact, she was in front of a firing squad.
But there's not a whisper of an echo of gender-based targeting or discrimination. She was a young officer with a big assignment and a demanding boss.
When Detective Fisher or another detective that was a male in this department had a John Doe investigation, and it was a large ongoing investigation, the command staff embraced that John Doe investigation. When McKenzie had the John Doe, it was not embraced. It was only requested to be halted, and Deputy Inspector Paris never brought forth one single reason at any time to Sergeant Hagedorn, to Detective McKenzie, or anyone else as to why the case needed to be sped up or rushed through or completed. It was not until after this case was started when defense counsel got involved, when reasons came up for why this case should be stopped, why it needed to be halted. These are all after-the-fact legal arguments, Your Honor. Moreover, going to the May 10th meeting, Detective Fisher again, and this one is on tape, went up to Detective McKenzie after the meeting and said, "Mac, you had a set of balls, I'd say they really busted them today." And now defense counsel is coming in today trying to make it sound like, oh, this was an all rosy meeting and Deputy Inspector Perez didn't take any steps to intimidate or coerce McKenzie during the meeting, when in fact Detective Fisher is on tape as saying that to McKenzie immediately following this meeting. And let's go to the May 14th, 2001 meeting, a meeting in which Deputy Inspector Perez, who the prior Friday before went storming through the Drug Enforcement Unit to make a point that he was looking for McKenzie, a point that Detective Rivera felt so compelled to page McKenzie at her home, who had the day off, to let her know Deputy Inspector Perez was storming through the unit to look for her. Going back to the May 14th meeting, Deputy Inspector Perez not only told McKenzie that he felt she was inappropriate in her treatment or her conduct, but that if you did this to any other captain or deputy inspector in the department, you'd have your head handed to you. I don't think that is something that is not intimidating or coercive.
Well,
he didn't say that to any male.
In a paramilitary organization, if your commander tells you to sit down, do you sit down?
They make it sound like, if you listen to the tape and if you review the transcript, it was very lightly said by Deputy Inspector, "Please sit down."
No matter how it said.
"Please sit down."
If it shrieked at you, do you sit down?
She did. After she realized that he said for a second time, "Please sit down," she sat down.
But again, in a paramilitary organization, do you have to say it twice?
This was not a situation where it was an order. It's not insubordination. Everyone at the meeting said it was not insubordinate. It wasn't inappropriate or disrespectful. It was one of those situations, like I am today, giving a presentation to the panel. If one of you interrupt with a question, I might be in the middle of a statement and you might ask it again before I have attention to even draw back to the question. It was something so subtle as that. It was nothing inappropriate or in your face. Nothing like that. It was one of those situations that's been trumped up to be more than it is.
I think we do have the point, and thank you very much, Mr.
Redko. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Indeed, the court thanks both Mr. Redko and Ms. Ferguson for their help today, and the case will be taken under advisement.